everybody. Welcome back to the NXpress Nintendo Switch podcast. I am your interim host, Patrick Murphy. Tim Mason, of course, is still on parental leave. Those kids, I tell you, they ruin everything. But joining me, as always, is the childless, I'm assuming, Ricky D.
What's up, Patrick? What's up, Nintendo Nation?
It's going to be an interesting show today. We're basically... There's not been a ton of Nintendo news. We had the Direct, you know, last week. So, of course, that was, like, the big news. But we have been playing quite a few games, so we're going to get into that. And we've also got a section. We're going to start talking a little bit about our gaming habits, just some of our habits that we have relating to indie and AAA games. Joining us to discuss that will be Isaac Barnett.
Hey, guys.
We've been playing quite a bit. I think we've each been playing some indies, some Nintendo Online. There was a new game that dropped right after the Direct, Tetris 99. I think, Rick, you've checked that out. And maybe, Isaac, you have too. I don't have Nintendo Online yet. I'm still waiting for a better reason. Yeah, but anyway, well, let's jump right into it then. What have both of you guys been playing Tetris 99?
I have a little bit. Rick, have you been playing it a lot?
I have. I love this game. I think it is one of my favorite games of the year. And I know the year just started, like, you know, we're only like month two. But yeah, it's really, really good. It's really, really fun. I'm a huge fan of Tetris. Tetris is one of my maybe 10 favorite games of all time. Like, if put a gun to my head and ask me to choose my 10 favorite games of all time, and Tetris is automatically going to come up. It's a safe bet, right? So this game to me was just like a no-brainer. I mean, I'm also a huge fan of Tetris Effect, which was released last year. So it's like Tetris is all of a sudden in style. It's making this huge comeback. And the thing about the original Tetris is you got to remember that the original Tetris came bundled with the Game Boy. And a lot of people would argue that one of the reasons why the Game Boy was such a success was because of the game Tetris. Everybody wanted to play Tetris. So even though technically Tetris is not a game made by Nintendo, and you can play Tetris on just about any system that's been released since the Game Boy, it was, I believe, exclusive to the Game Boy. Or no, it wasn't exclusive to
it
the Game
not.
Boy.
It was not.
It was not, but it was like everybody PCs. Was playing it on the Game Boy when it came out.
So yeah, that's popularized. The Game Boy massively popularized Tetris.
And the NES version too.
Parents were playing Game Boys just simply for Tetris.
Right. So it was sold on a range of home computer platforms at the time it was released for the Game Boy. But since that Game Boy version, there's been tons of different variations of the game Tetris, including multiplayer Tetris. But we've never had a game in which you can play with 98 people. And I'm not a huge fan of Battle Royale games. Like, I've played Fortnite. I just can't get into it. Although I really do like Apex Legends, but it's still a first-person shooter, which is not really my thing. I think of all the Battle Royale games, this is by far my favorite. So it's like the most famous puzzle game of all time is making this huge comeback in the form of a Battle Royale online multiplayer like extravaganza. And it is free to play, sort of. It's only free to play if you have the Nintendo Online service. So technically it's free for people who have the service, but if you don't have the service, you have to buy the service, which, you know, like, Patrick, it wouldn't necessarily be free for you. If you wanted to play Tetris 99 and you had no reason really to get the Nintendo Online subscription, you're basically paying for this online subscription in order to play Tetris 99. But still, I think it's like the biggest surprise that Nintendo dropped on us so far this year. Like, maybe some people would argue Super Mario Maker, but I think a lot of people could have predicted that would happen. Whereas, like, a Tetris Battle Royale game just came out of nowhere.
That is a weird one, for sure. My question is this. Like, Tetris is already super intense. Like, when you get up to the higher levels, it starts to get pretty nerve-wracking anyway. How is it when you're competing against 90 other people, and can you actually affect each other?
It's pure chaos, and yeah, you can affect the other players. Like, that's what makes it so incredibly hard. So the thing about this is, like, if you're going to play Tetris 99, I actually recommend playing on handheld mode. And the reason why is you can use a touchscreen. And so it makes it easier if you want to attack your opponents, because you could just use your fingers and, like, you know, touch whoever it is you want to attack. Whereas with the docked mode, you have to use the R button and sort of, like, control your cursor and point it to wherever it is that you want to attack. But it is super, super difficult. Like, I have not yet finish in first place. The closest I've come to finishing first place is I believe I ended up on the top 10. And you would assume that when you get to the top 10, it would make things easier because there's, like, less people to compete with, but it actually makes it easier for people to attack you.
to target you. Yeah, you're much safer when you're in a big crowd.
but it's great having this game exclusive to the Switch, because like I said, Tetris has this long history dating back to what I believe was 1984, or was it 1989?
I think it was 89.
89, well,
on
yeah.
The game, on the Game Boy, or it's originally yeah. released?
Well, the original release was 84.
Yeah, something like that, because it was developed by that Russian programmer, or whatever, Soviet programmer.
Exactly.
Who developed it, and he didn't get money for it till quite a while later. But
yes, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Soviet Union, that's the way things worked back then.
So Nintendo can't claim ownership on the game, but like I said, it's the Game Boy that really... yep. made it a household name. But the thing about this game, Patrick, is it's so fun to play. And what I love about it too is like you can get in, and this is kind of like a pro and a con, because you can start a game and your match will be over within 30 seconds.
Oh, great. So you got your butt kicked is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. But then you can pick up and start again. Like you just hold down A and you ask for a rematch. Or when you die, you can stay and watch the progress to see who ends up in first place. Because, like, say you die at position number 69, you'll be able to see who died prior to you, but not who will die next until they die, which means you have to stick around and actually wait to see who comes in first place.
So you're telling me that you'll get demoralized from getting beat in 30 seconds. Then you can stick around and get demoralized by watching just how good some of these people are.
Pretty much. Exactly.
I don't know if you guys have played Tetris Effect, but it's completely opposite in terms of like the tone and the pacing, because Tetris Effect is this really relaxing game that's a love letter to the original Tetris. Tetris 99 is pure chaos. It's madness. It's like Tetris on speed. It's like Tetris on crack. It's like really intense.
Isaac, what drug would you liken it to?
I have no idea. All I know is that I personally think it feels a little frustrating for me to play because I haven't played many Tetris games, right? So I never really liked Tetris all that much. I know that's crazy, but I really haven't played it. And so coming into this game, I'm like, oh, I'm going to try this out. You know, maybe it'll be fun. Maybe they'll have like a practice mode where you can like build your skills or something like that before you play online. Well, no, it doesn't. You're just playing online. That's it.
And that's something they've assumed probably that most people have played Tetris, but I have a feeling this would be one of the worst places to start playing Tetris.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because I like on these online sort of games to have an ability to kind of get a feel for what I'm going into, right? So Overwatch has the practice arena, you know, Apex has that little technical like practice tutorial area or whatever. This doesn't have anything like that. There's not even like an online versus just yourself sort of offline versus yourself sort of mode or something. And so going in, it can be a little bit frustrating because the game literally has zero tutorial about what does what, and so you end up having to go online and try to figure a lot of this stuff out. Game Explain, I actually watched their video about how to actually play the game because there's no in-game explanation for anything.
He's not lying. There's no tutorial. Like it's baffling. Like I've been playing this game for like about a week now and I still do not know if I understand how the game entirely works. Like the thing about this game is it's twisted, it's unforgiving, it's cold. But the fact that there's no tutorial doesn't help, because if you're a newcomer to Tetris, like you guys said, you're going to be completely lost. The game itself functions like the original game. Like you have the exact same blocks, the exact same shapes. They're even the exact same colors with the exact same soundtrack. But instead of fighting for a high score, you're fighting just to stay alive and to be the very last man standing.
What I like about this game, though, is spectating it, because I've went on YouTube and watched some people with some crazy Tetris skills go through. Like one guy had a 23 elimination game I watched. It was just crazy to watch. It's really fun. It's a spectator thing for me. But to play it, not so much, because I don't like games where, like, basically there's no tools for me to get better by myself, where basically I have to go in and online look it up and do stuff like that, it feels like there's a big skill curve to overcome. But as far as I can tell, it doesn't feel like there's any matchmaking with this. And so I'm not getting matched up with, like, terrible players. I'm getting matched up with just the general population.
It does keep track of your level. Like, you do move up a level as you continue to play and get better and better.
Tetris is so ubiquitous that most people are probably better than you, Isaac. Like, just so you're getting matched up with people better than you because most people probably have played it quite a bit.
Yeah, but there's a system. I totally agree with that. I'm terrible at Tetris. What I'm saying, though, is, like, there's in most games, there's, like, an ELO system, right? In Smash, it's called Global Smash Power or whatever. It's basically like some sort of ELO system. There's rankings in Overwatch or whatever. Something like that that matches me against like more scrubby people, they're terrible Tetris like I am, would be recommended. But it's a free game, so I'm not complaining. I don't have to play it. I got other games I can play, right, that I'm better at. And but yeah, I mean, it's my fault for going in and trying to play this, like, you know, baby's first Tetris, right? Because I've never played Tetris before. So
I'm not entirely sure if they can have any kind of sort of like matched ranking, because how could you? I mean, because the thing about Tetris is like I said, when you're actually playing the game, it's no different than the original Tetris. It's the additional 98 players that change it up, right? Because they start attacking you. But for example, imagine if none of those players attacked you. You would just be playing basically the classic Tetris.
Well, yeah, I get what you're saying. But I meant like...
So the thing is, like, what I'm saying is that you don't know who you're going to get matched with. So like everyone would have to be on the exact same level, because like for example, like the game keeps track of your stats. So not just how many times you've won, not just what level you're at, but also how many knockouts you had, how many targets you stole, and how many garbage blocks you've sent over to a different opponent. And so how would you find a way to have an AI come up with an algorithm that would match you with the people that are on your same skill level? Because some people might be really good at knocking players out, but they're not actually good at actually winning the game. Maybe they've never even won a game. It's one of those games, like, I'm not entirely sure how they can do it.
I mean, they do that with like pretty much every other game. Like, it's like Smash has a ranking system, right? So when I go like in a
right, but you're not system, playing with 98 people though at the same time.
But that's not really the problem though. I get what you're saying. It's a lot harder with 98 than it is for like the, you know, 16 when you're playing Overwatch people that you're ranking with or whatever. It's hard enough there. You get a lot of spread. But
the thing is though, is that it has the random target, right? So like when, like, you can use this thing called, like, when you randomly target players, and if someone uses that whatever you call it, that control scheme to randomly target players, it's random. It's like there's no way that any kind of algorithm could understand that this player is within the same skill level as you.
Yeah. Ironically enough, when the first match I played on this, I got 23rd, and I haven't got better than that since then. So
that's not bad. That's pretty good.
No, I mean I generally know how to play Tetris. It's not the Tetris part that's hard. It's the junk blocks from other players hard thing. Because sometimes I've gotten to like a top 50 or whatever and been playing and doing good with the actual Tetris part. That part's fun. Like, I'm like, wow, Tetris is more fun than I thought it was going to be. You know, I've avoided it because it kind of looked like a, you know, kind of a relic of the past sort of thing. And then recently I got to play in Dr. Mario or whatever. And I'm like, well, maybe I should try Tetris out. So I gave this a chance. But it's the junk blocks from the other players. And that's kind of what's the aggravating part. Is because it feels so impersonal. So somebody, you know, wastes you in Fortnite or something, right? It feels a little bit more personal, like, well, I could have done something different. In this case, you can just pull the bad luck of the draw and have, like, four people target you at the same time, and it just fills you up with trash blocks, and you're done.
If four people target you at the same time, it is personal, Isaac.
Yeah.
I would honestly recommend you play the original Tetris game. I think you would like it. I think it's a game that stands the test of time, and I understand why some people say that it seems dated, but I don't think so at all. I think it stands the test of time. One thing about this game is it really made me understand why people complain about the D-pad on the Pro Controller.
Yes.
Because, okay, so Patrick, the way it works is that...
Oh, it's terrible. The D-pad
The thing about the D-pad in this game is like, okay, so if you press up, what it does is it automatically drops your block down to the ground level, right? So you don't have to wait for the block to start moving.
Wait, you press up to drop your blocks? I thought you always pushed
down. No, it's instant drop. If you press up, it's an instant drop. It will automatically drop, and the next block would appear. So the trick to playing this game and winning is to continuously press up as fast as you can, drop your block automatically so the next block reappears right away, and you speed through the game instead of waiting for the block to kind of like make its way down, right? So, but the problem is that sometimes you'll want to press left or right, and you'll end up pressing up, and so it'll automatically drop your block in the wrong spot.
Oh, yeah.
And you just cause yourself, like, a huge problem.
That gamepad, or that touchpad, what I'm talking about, the D-pad is unplayable on the Pro Controller. It's just, you can't do anything with that. It's like a waste of button space. I mean, it's absolutely atrocious. I love... conversely, I love the Joy-Con, using the Joy-Con buttons as a D-pad. That works really well. That's how I've played a lot of side-scrolling games. I prefer that over the joysticks, usually, because it's just so precise. But
Yeah, I don't have that huge of a gripe with the Pro Controller, or more so the D-pad. Like I do think it gets annoying when playing a game like this because the game is just so chaotic and it speeds up. It's the only time I really noticed me having an issue with the D-pad, but I still continue to play with the Pro Controller. It just made me more self-aware of the D-pad, and I made fewer mistakes. I think the last three times I played, I didn't even make any mistakes whatsoever. In fact, right before doing the podcast is when I came in 11th spot, so I was pretty close to beating my own personal record, which is number 10, I believe.
Nice. So your juices are flowing right now. You're amped up right now.
Yeah, but the only problem with this game is you can't play on the go. You need internet, right? And so I just wish, and I think I've asked for this like a year ago, I asked Nintendo on this podcast, can you please give us Tetris on the Switch? They gave us Tetris, but it's Tetris 99, which requires you to be plugged in online. And the thing is, I would hands down play Tetris on the bus or the train heading to like work. You know what I mean? Like Tetris would be hands down my go-to game when I'm on the go.
And some would say that's a microcosm of Nintendo themselves. They give you exactly what you want, but not how you want it. but you guys have been playing a much more relaxed game, from what I understand, on Nintendo Online. Now, I did try this game out when I briefly had my free subscription of Nintendo Online, Kirby's Adventure. I don't remember it being... I will say this. I'm starting to kind of, you know, wane on Kirby a little bit. I'm not becoming the, you know, after Star Allies, I'm kind of thinking like, I'm not sure the next Kirby's a must buy for me. They're going to have to do something to impress me. So when I started playing Adventure, I just thought, yeah, this is just more Kirby. Didn't really mean much to me. But you guys seem to really like this game.
Well, I haven't been playing it recently. I played it when I was younger, and I played it again on the Wii U. And I think it's ahead of its time. Like, when this game was released, it was ahead of its time. I think it's an amazing game. I think it's one of the best games released for the Nintendo Entertainment System. And I think it's one of the games that just does not get enough credit. Like, a lot of times when people talk about the best Kirby games, I think this game should be easily in the top three.
Yeah, I have a personal history with this game. More specifically, its remake on the Game Boy Advance. It was called like Kirby Nightmare in Dreamland or whatever. It's like a remake of this game. Funnily enough, when I was a kid, that game, Nightmare in Dreamland, the remake of this game, was at GameStop for like $20, right? I had $20. I was like, oh, I love Kirby games. I'm going to go buy this. Bought it, and I beat it the next day. And I was so disappointed that the game was that short, because I had played Kirby the Amazing Mirror or whatever on Game Boy Advance when I was a kid. And this game was much shorter than that once. I remember being so disappointed. But as the Nintendo Switch Online version of this game... As for NES games go, I don't like most of them because they're kind of archaic and they don't haven't really stood up to the test of time. This and Super Mario Brothers 3 are like two of the, and the original Super Mario Brothers, I would say, are probably only three of the must-play original NES games. This one, just because of how beautiful the graphics are for an NES game. I read online this game came in at 6 megabit on the NES, which is just crazy. It's an enormous NES game.
It was, and, but it was also released at the tail end of the system's life cycle. Like
93, 91?
The Super NES was out already.
The Super NES was out. This was like sort of like the swan song. It was also the first game to feature the power copying for the protagonist.
Yeah, because the original Kirby's Dream Land on Game Boy, which I've also played, did not have that.
I completely disagree with what you just said about only few NES games stand a test of time. I can easily give you a list of about 100. Super Mario Bros. 3 is probably the best in the series, in my opinion, but there's so many great games released on the NES.
See, I'm kind of with Isaac, and you, Rick, you and I both grew up under the NES, and I grew up with an NES, right at the sweet spot of, like, years old. And I gotta agree with Isaac, I can't go back and play NES games anymore. To me, they're gone. It's like trying to play N64 games. So I consider the two generations that are kind of useless now to be the NES and the N64. I would much rather play SNES and GameCube.
Era. Oh, yeah.
They actually refined the gameplay to accommodate. Like, they refined the NES with the Super NES, and it just, everything, it works so much better. The visuals stand the test of time. They still make games like that now. They make less games that look like actual NES games. Usually the so-called NES indies are actually sort of a hybrid with the amount of colors and pixels they display.
This could be a whole entire different talk spot.
It could.
Just quickly off the top of my head, I'm going to name off like the original Legend of Zelda, which pretty much you know, without it, there wouldn't be your favorite Link like to the Past.
So, no, there's history.
There's also Contra, the original Ninja Gaiden. Yeah. Like, everyone's raving about The Messenger. Just go back and play Ninja Gaiden. It's just as good. There's so many great games. Anyways, this is a talk spot for another day, because you guys are getting me really mad right now.
It's historically relevant, but it's like, would you rather play Contra?
I don't
Contra
even think it's historically relevant. I think they Contra. Stand a test of time. They stand a test of time.
They work. They work like Pac-Man works.
Pac-Man works. Stands a test of time.
Sort of. I mean, it's all right for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's
which is what I give most NES games. That's what happened when I got the online service, by the way, for the free trial thing. I played everything for 5 minutes, and I knew I'd never play any of them ever again. That was it.
I'm actually pulling up our list of the greatest Nintendo games right now. We are totally off track here, and I don't care. This is your fault for bringing this up. God damn it, you guys are getting me mad right now. This is like when Aaron Santos. Well, remember when Aaron Santos was on the podcast and he was talking trash about the NES and just like lost it on him about how important that video game console is?
It's super important. See, I'm not criticizing like the historical relevance.
So here's the thing. Let me make my case. A lot of people, like whenever you see lists online from like IGN and Polygon, whatever, a lot of these critics and group of critics will place the game like Super Mario Brothers as number one of all time. Now, you could argue if that's the number one game of all time, but it's always in the discussion. As is Super Mario Bros. 3, also an NES game, which a lot of people argue is the best in the series. A game like Duck Hunt is just legendary, but also stands the test of time. And there's no game like it to this day. So there's there's the Zelda games. There's Dragon Warrior. There's the original Warrior. Metroid game.
I played that.
Okay, so
rough.
We can argue that Super Metroid is a way better game than the original Metroid game.
The original Metroid's a mess.
The original Metroid's a mess. Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. You're going to tell me that doesn't stand the test of time? The original Mega Man games. Everyone says those first six games are by far the best in the series.
X was better.
Yeah, I was about to say, what most people say Mega Man X was better than
everything was done better on the SNES. There's not a single NES game
you're
that didn't have a Super
you're
NES
gonna
counterpart.
You're argue
that
point with the guy who says his favorite console of all time is a Super NES. That's not the point I'm trying to make. That's a whole completely different argument. The point I'm trying to make is that he said that the games on the NES, all but three, are dated, and I'm like, that's a huge exaggeration. I'm not comparing this to the Super NES, because the Super NES is far superior in every single which way possible. That's not the argument I'm making. The argument I'm making is that he is wrong. There is by far more than three games that stand the test of time on the NES.
Yeah, I disagree. I think those games don't stand the test of time. Like I say, I don't think NES and N64 games stand the test of time at all. There's not a single one that I would rather play than its counterpart on a different system. I just think they had a thing going with the NES, and it was great for the time. They refined it with the SNES, and I would never go back. I would never go back to the crude version when they have the refined version.
The only thing I would disagree with you about on is I would rather play Super Mario 64 any day than Super Mario Sunshine. That's the only...
There are exceptions.
But besides that, I agree.
I also agree that the N64 games are, of all the generations, they are the games that have a tougher time of aging well because of those polygon 3D graphics and the camera system, especially on 64. Super Mario 64 is an incredible game, but the camera just annoys the crap out of me. Again, the point I'm trying to make here is that is a huge exaggeration saying only three games.
I don't know.
There was also Street Fighter 2010 on the NES, wasn't there?
I mean, here's the thing. There are fun games when you just sort of like try to forget that other video games exist. There are games on the NES. But
it's true.
But it's like
hurt.
Saying I could have fun with Atari 2600 games, but they don't stand the test of time.
My big gripe with the NES games is the artificial difficulty. Like, otherwise, I have no problem with, like, a lot of the way they play or whatever, but it's just the artificial difficulty that they had for good reasons back in the day.
Yeah, arcade mentality.
Yeah, but it's just, I don't like that, because it's like Super Mario Bros. 3, for the most part, does not have that artificial difficulty. That's why it's a good game.
Until you get Kirby's to the very last level.
Yeah, Kirby's Adventure doesn't have that sort of, it doesn't really have much difficulty at all, but that's not the point. You know, it does have that sort of artificial difficulty. The original Super Mario Bros., it builds you up a test of skill. That's why those games are good. In my opinion, right? So, you can argue RPGs or pseudo RPGs like Zelda have aged a little better than the others, but I don't know. The original Dragon Warrior is pretty rough. I played that a couple years ago.
Punch-Out might be the only one that I would say is better than all the other Punch-Outs. Even that might be the only one that I NES game
better than Punch-Out on the Wii.
I think
I would say so.
Yeah. Because no, I just think I felt like it was more precise.
I got you.
I would agree. I think the Punch-Out's like, I mean, it's funny because like when we, if we were to make a list of, and we have, Patrick and I, and we made a list of like the 100 greatest NES games, and we were trying to figure out what would be in like first spot. And, you know, some people would argue Super Mario Bros. 3, Super Mario Bros. 1, that's a given. Some people would say the original Legend of Zelda because it's the first. But Punch-Out was always in the conversation.
Yeah. It's a really, really, really well-polished game that I don't think anybody's done better. Not even Nintendo.
But Kirby's Adventure, so you finished the game.
No. I mean, I played it a little bit for like, I don't remember how long exactly, but I played some of it. Because I've already beaten this game before, like I said, I beat it on the Game Boy Advance version, which if people have a Wii U, I would recommend you check that version out. It's a lot prettier or whatever. But this version is great. Like I just like looking at this game from a technical point of view about how advanced it is for an NES game. Like you look at this and you look at Super Mario Brothers and you're like, how are these two games on the same system? That's how big of a gulf there is in terms of how complicated the visuals are, right? And that's why I really like this game. And plus, you know, it's a Sakurai game. It's Masahiro Sakurai game, you know, creator of Smash Brothers, creator of Kirby. And every game he makes or whatever, it's touched with these little details. And it's really neat to see him grow as a director in this game.
There's actually 42 different levels. It's spread across 7 different worlds. And I think you can beat this game within like a few hours.
Yeah, it's probably a 3-hour game.
Yeah,
at the most. I mean, it's a very short game. I just haven't had the time to put into it, you know, to finish it. And it's, it controls pretty good. I've never really liked how Kirby feels as a platformer. It's just so floaty and slow. But it's still a good Kirby game. I think it's better than Star Allies, I'll be honest. But it's a good Kirby game.
I'm surprised they didn't include that on the SNES Mini. But I guess they have Kirby's.
Mini?
Our SNES Mini, the Super NES Classic.
Include what?
Is Kirby's Adventure? Oh, I'm sorry, the NES. Oh, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, you're thinking about Kirby Superstar, right?
I think I am.
Yeah.
It was released in 1993. I just looked
at it. 93, which is insanely late because the Super NES came out in 91, right?
91, yeah.
Yeah.
Kirby's usually been the swan song. Like, a Kirby game is usually the swan song for a Nintendo console. Doesn't necessarily mean it's, like, the last game that gets released for a console. But if you look at all of Nintendo's consoles, usually towards the end of the life cycle, there's a Kirby game that gets released.
When did Kirby 64 come out? In the 64, right?
I know that it never even crossed my mind to buy it.
Yeah, I've never bought it, and I still...
I think the GameCube might have been pretty close to coming out, and I was saving for that. I don't even remember thinking twice about Kirby 64, because I'm assuming I was thinking more about the GameCube.
Yeah, it's the only game that limited his jumps. That's all I know about it. It made it where he only had 5 jumps or something. You could combine powers in that game, kind of like you could in Star Allies.
You're a madman. Like, here you are talking shit about old NES games, and you're at home playing an old NES game and loving it.
I told you it was one of the three that stood the test of time. Big difference. Right. I could compromise and say there are 10 good NES games.
All right, but Isaac has also been playing a much more recent game.
Yeah, but not necessarily a better game.
Oh, really?
No. So I've been playing Starlink Battle for Atlas on Switch. Which I know a bunch of our listeners have heard Patrick talk about for a long time.
He raved about that game. Loves that game.
Can't wait for the new update.
This is my catch line with this game. I've never played a game that epitomized the feel of a 7 out of 10 more than this game is. It feels in every way like a 7 out of 10.
Wait, is that a bad thing?
I can agree with that. I think I actually referenced that in an article I wrote, that it is a 7 or an 8 at the most.
Yeah, or 3.5 on our scale.
But a 7... A 7 can be an extremely good game to some people.
Yeah, for the $12 I paid for this game after a little bit of money had my PayPal moved over I got for $20 off Newegg. It's not too bad because I got the physical edition of this game with the R-Wing and everything, which is amazing, right? So quick side note, I love the R-Wing. As a kid, I built my own R-Wing out of Legos. So getting an actual R-Wing in a box was awesome. That was worth the price of the mission alone. So I'm pretty happy about that. As a game, it's not too bad, but I can't help thinking every time I play this game, man, if Ubisoft would have got together with Nintendo, made this a Star Fox game, and released it exclusively for Switch, we'd all be raving about it right now.
I think Nintendo did them a favor. I don't think this was meant to have Star Fox included. This game was just Starlink, And yeah, then because they're all buddy-buddy with Nintendo, and Nintendo just can't get a Star Fox game made right for the life of them, they decided at the last minute to include Star Fox.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, Nintendo suggested it, actually. They saw Starlink, and they said, hey, you know what? That would work for Star Fox. Do you guys want to add Star Fox in there?
Yeah, that's the only redeeming quality about this game, sort of, plot or characters or anything.
But it's a big one, though, right? Because
yeah,
it makes it
it's
feel
so charming.
I think it feels kind of like a Star... I would love to see a Star Fox game like this, and I agree with that if they got together, they could make a better game, but that's why I wanted to see this game succeed, so that they do make this like a Star Fox game next time around.
That's what I was saying, was that I wish this game would have been a Switch exclusive, and that Ubisoft would just scrap releasing it on other consoles when it's very bland without Fox, right? Right? This game without Fox, without all the Star Fox stuff, is just, I would never play it. It's so overall just a bland experience, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's kind of like, it's kind of like a ramen noodles game experience, right? You know what you're getting. I paid cheap for it, and it fills you up, but it's not something that like really just impresses you. And that's where I felt playing this. And a big part of that, like, not impressive part is obviously the story's terrible. I mean, it's like just
it's not awful.
It's just completely stupid, and it's like
I warned you, by the way. I warned you about that.
Oh yeah, I wasn't expecting much, but it's like it's worse than some Saturday morning cartoons I've seen, right?
Yes, it is.
Some kids shows. Like, they have better plot progression. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Outside Star Fox, the characters are so obnoxious.
Yeah, so the dude who wants to obviously be like a Fortnite streamer.
Yes. Oh, he's just amazingly terrible.
Yeah, he's annoying. It's like a ripoff of like there's all sorts of characters that you just feel like, oh my gosh, they just mailed this in.
You know what I don't understand? Well, first of all, I have a question for you. Is this game going to stand the test of time in 30 years? From now, is your son going to be like, this game is great?
No, this is not a classic. No,
so this is okay.
This is a bargain bin, pick it up for $5 game. That's what this is.
I ranted. See, I think it's worth a little more than that, because honestly, I put 60 hours into this game and I replayed it 100% it twice because I just like the gameplay loop so much. Now, you're only a few hours in. It does start to get more complex and more engaging when your multiple planets are under attack and you're kind of juggling back and forth between them. And you start taking on bigger ships. I'm not sure if you've ever done, if you've had the big space battle quite yet. But the gameplay loop for me became so satisfying that it was worth the $60 that I paid for it. Like, I think it was well worth it because I got so much out of it.
Wait, did you get the R-Wing?
No, I bought the digital version because it actually comes with more in-game weapons and stuff.
So wait, digital didn't come with the R-Wing?
It comes with a digital version of the R-Wing.
Yeah, digital version of the R-Wing.
You got the physical version of the R-Wing.
Yeah.
I only got the digital one.
Yeah. Which is fine, but
it gave me all the options that I need. It gave me, there's elemental attacks, and it gave me enough weapons that I was able to cover all the elements.
But that's the thing. If he wants to buy all of the additional stuff you got with the digital version, he's going to have to pay for it separately, which is actually going to cost him a lot more money at the end of the day.
You can buy digital packs, though, if he needs like a specific element, and I think you may want one digital pack to actually get the most out of it. But it could be difficult otherwise when you get to later planets, and it'll be more difficult to take certain enemies down, I think.
If you were to guess the percentage of sales on non-Nintendo consoles, what would you guess?
I guess 75% Nintendo and 25%.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, because why would you buy this on any other console? Because it's just bland.
I think you're being generous. I would say, yeah, like, I would say 10%. 80%.
Yeah, 80% on Nintendo, yeah. 20% on,
I would say 10 and 90% on Nintendo.
Star Fox really does jazz it up, and it has Star Fox missions, which is also good. They're specific to the Switch. Yeah.
Fox fits in so good with it. I was so surprised. I mean, yeah, he fits in well.
He fits in perfectly, and this is a 7 or 8 out of 10. I personally would, from a personal perspective, I would give this an 8, but I can definitely see a 7. It's just one of those 7 or 8s that is worth exploring if you're curious, because you may end up liking it as much as I did. Or, you may think it's bland like you. I can see the bland part, but I like it. It satisfied me for some reason.
I agree with that. I actually do like playing the game. It is fun. It's a fun, but it's very, like I said, it's a very sort of,
you can't
point
to a single thing, though, and be like, oh my god, the visuals are amazing, the plants are amazing.
That's the complaint I have. The biggest complaint is, for me, one of the biggest complaints is the visuals, because this game is good from an art design perspective, right? But I just can't help feeling, if this would have been a Switch exclusive, they could have got better graphics, because these graphics are not the greatest. No. In terms of the frame rate, is it locked at 30, which is, it's just okay. But this is kind of a fast-paced action game, and having a 30 FPS cap is kind of a downer for me. But the bigger issue altogether is the low rendering distance. So everything's really foggy out far. And it's like it looks like it's running about 720p or below, which is fine for a Switch game. But that rendering distance and the level of detail being really low is kind of a bummer, right? I feel like this would just been focused on releasing it on Switch and not having to be cross compatible with Xbox One and PS4, and I think it's on PC too. I don't remember. It would have been a whole lot better off because obviously the Switch could do a whole lot better visuals than these.
I would give this game a 1.5.
Wait, have you played it?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a good game. I think a lot of people like me will like it a lot, and other people will be kind of bored by it. It's one of those in-between games that, like I say, if you're curious, especially now that it really is cheap. I saw that same deal. Somebody on Reddit posted that it was only $20. So, I mean, for $20, anybody curious should check it out because it could end up being an amazing value for you.
Oh, I was very happy because just having the R-Wing itself is like a desk prop. And I'm normally not into these sort of like, you know, physical collectibles or something, right? But having it just as a desk prop has been one of my favorite, you know, starships from fictional universes or whatever. It's really cool.
It's cool. And I saw it at E3. It's a great figurine.
Yeah, it's like amiibo quality, right? But the actual Toys to Life aspect of it should never been a thing, right? It's not really integrated well. It's very sloppy.
That's why I bought the digital version too. Yeah, it's just so much easier to swap things.
You can quote unquote go digital as on the physical version if you're playing like handheld and you dock it on the Switch. You dock the Joy-Cons on the Switch. You can click a button to go digital and just keep playing without having to have the portal or whatever attached.
Yeah, so you just have to check in like once a week, I think.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting, right? I mean, it like I said, it's not bad. It's definitely about as what I expected. But it's pretty fun, just kind of a back and chill sort of game. You don't have to really think of too much when you play it.
Yes, and there you go. That is exactly it. It is a sit back and chill sort of game. That's why I liked it so much. It was a super relaxing game for me to play after work. Like, I just enjoyed playing. So I could zone out and zoom across the surface of planets and shoot some stuff. And it occasionally got challenging fighting some of the big ships, but it never got so intense that I'd feel like I was, you know, ramped up or something or too tense. I just, it was a great game to relax to.
Yeah, I definitely, for $20, I definitely recommend picking it up if you're even slightly interested in it, especially if you got the physical edition and then you can, like, you know, flip it or keep the R-Wing or do what you want to with it. Definitely wouldn't recommend picking it up on anything but Switch.
I would actually love to meet someone who does not own a Switch and bought this game for the Xbox or PlayStation. Yeah, I would love to meet this person.
I actually went and watched a guy review the Xbox One X version because I wanted to see what it looked like on Xbox One X to compare the visuals. And it just looks
different.
Yeah, there's like no Fox, and I'm like, oh my gosh, how is this guy playing this game, right? Because Fox itself is like the core of the game, in my opinion, in terms of what makes it fun to play. Because
your pilot talks quite a bit.
Yeah, having Fox talks like, oh yeah.
Thankfully, that's Fox, because if it was one of the other guys that I had to listen to for the entire game, I would not enjoy it. I'd have to turn the sound off.
Yeah. But
because you have Fox talking the entire time, it totally increases the charm of the game.
That is why I'm hoping to God we get a Star Fox game announced at E3, because I love Star Fox, and I think the character himself, just the fact that when you insert him into this game, it takes the game from being a bad game to a pretty, like, average or okay game worth spending, like, 60 hours on. Like, Star Fox is such a powerful character, and he has such a huge following, and now they're including the rest of the characters in the game. Like, Nintendo needs to... I mean, they don't need to do anything, but it would be great if they released a Star Fox game on the Switch. Because the problem with the Star Fox game on Wii U, which, by the way, happened to really love, is a lot of people just didn't like the controls, because it was locked into using the gamepad.
Yeah, so I actually got a question about that. I've never played Star Fox Zero. It's like $10 now. Is it worth picking up?
I love it. Oh, yeah. Honestly, it's for $10, it's totally worth it. It's really short. You'll finish it in a night.
And here's the thing, Isaac. Play it with somebody. Like, okay. Play it, you know, with family or something. Because as a co-op game, it's kind of like that scene in Star Wars where, you know, you've got you can have somebody be your Han Solo behind the guns and somebody else is piloting the ship. They call it the Millennium Falcon mode. Like, I loved playing with my brother. You know, one of us would shoot and the other one would fly. And you can still shoot while you're flying. But, it was great that way.
Like, I was a big fan of Star Fox Assault on GameCube, which I know a lot of people didn't like. I actually really liked it. And that's an idea, you know, when I was thinking about, you know, looking at Starlink from a Star Fox perspective, I was like, wow, you know, if these missions on the actual planet surface would have been like landmaster missions, right? That would have been like so cool from like a, you know, think about the next Star Fox or something, have it be an open world like that. It's a really neat idea, I think. A lot of people didn't like in Star Fox Assault how you could get out of the vehicles and do stuff like that. As a kid, I really liked that. And I would love to see a Star Fox game kind of take that approach in the future.
It all depends on how it controls, I think. And I think a lot of people had the problem with the way the on-ground stuff actually controlled. It was kind of clunky. But if you can make it smooth, then it works. And I personally, like, after playing Starlink, that's how I want the next Star Fox game to be. I want it to be the seamless galaxy where I can fly through space and go straight into a world, no loading screens, nothing. Just fly in there and go from place to place and do missions. Like, this would be a great formula for the next Star Fox game, and I hope Nintendo has sort of taken notice that, okay, Starlink maybe didn't, like, do gangbusters business, although they're still supporting it with free content, which is great. It didn't do gangbusters business, but maybe it can be a foundation for something they work on together in the future.
Do you think that the reason why they're adding additional characters so late after the game gets released is because we are going to get a Star Fox game and they're trying to continuously promote Star Fox or anyone who did buy Starlink?
I don't know. It's weird, though,
because it didn't sell that much. And exactly. So yet they're supporting it still, which is just bizarre to me, with free updates. And
it might be under Ubisoft's agreement with Nintendo, though, to make
possibly.
It.
Possibly.
Ubisoft has way better and bigger things to do than worry about adding characters into a game that's not selling well.
Yeah, I can't see Nintendo saying, like, no, you guys have to do this because you promised. I think Nintendo would understand, like, DLC is just one of those things that I think they're doing it because I think they're trying to figure out what they can do for the next one to make the next one more successful. I think this was an experimental IP for them. And it's a little rough around the edges. And I think this is just a way for them. This is almost like doing research, maybe, to see how many people are going to play the new modes and, you know, how are people doing with the old modes? Will this get people back into the game? That kind of stuff. Like, can this be a viable property in the future?
I still think we're getting that Star Fox Grand Prix game that supposedly Retro was working on. I think we'll eventually see that.
82% of units were sold on Switch.
That seems about right.
Yep. Where's that from?
Everywhere. I'm actually going through Google, and every single article has the exact same statistic, 82%.
Well, hopefully that shows Nintendo, right, that people want this sort of Star Fox experience.
And hopefully it shows Ubisoft that if they're going to continue this and do it with Star Fox, just do Nintendo Switch. It's worthless to develop it for other things, so make it focused on Switch so that they can do a better job optimizing it.
Because the vast differences between, like, the PS4 and Xbox One's architectures and the Switches, I mean, they could have made a lot more optimizations if they just went straight with the Switch.
PS4 took 10%.
Oh, wow, so Xbox got, like, nothing.
Yes, I could talk about Starlink forever, but
yeah, I'm honestly impressed a little bit from what I was considering. And it's just like you said, it's kind of fun to just sit down and play it and just, you know, go scan some alien bioforms and blast some, you know, MacGuffin bad guys, whatever.
Starlink is good old fashioned wholesome fun. It reminds me of old school video games in many ways. The way the stupid dialogue is, and
or even in.
And just kind of the basic missions that you go on. Like, it's not a collectathon or anything like that. So thankfully that's not present. But the way the stuff you do just sort of reminds me of old fashioned video gaming. And I thought that was super relaxing for the time I put into it.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, though, don't use if you get the physical version, don't use that included. What's it called? Portal grip for the Joy-Cons. It's terrible. So, like, you got, like, this spaceship sitting on top of your thumbs when you're trying to play, and it's a horrible experience. Don't ever do that.
I used that at E3. I didn't care for it, although I was trying to be as nice as I could to the Ubisoft rep who was explaining it to me, but I did not like it. Another reason I just went digital, and I do not regret that purchase at all. Just bought it on a whim, too.
All right, everything looks good.
Wow! This Starlink tech is amazing!
This'll give us the edge we need to take down Wolf.
Least we could do. Good luck.
Let's rock and roll, boys.
Catch you later.
So I do want to bring up a new game that I played that came out on Valentine's Day last week. And I'll be putting a review up very soon. It might even be up by the time this podcast is posted. But it is for a game called Degrees of Separation. All right. So I'm a big puzzle gamer. as anybody who listens to the podcast knows, I love puzzle games of all shapes and sizes. Box Boy is my most anticipated game of the year. So this was something that I thought, you know, I'm going to review an indie game. I don't really know which one. I took a look at some of the previews for games that were releasing recently, and I thought this one kind of looked nice, and I like puzzle games. So I wasn't expecting a whole lot, though, because this game's big catch is that it's co-op. It's a co-op puzzle game. Well, I don't normally play games with other people, so, but I think I'm objective enough that I can tell whether something will work as a co-op game while playing it. Because the game also states that you can play it single player. So I thought, all right, I'm going to see how it plays single player. And, you know, I think that I can determine whether this would work better as a co-op game. You know, maybe it's going to be really clunky. I was expecting something very, very clunky as far as a single player game, because those games tend to be, when you're one player and you're taking control of two characters, it tends to get really tedious with swapping. Like, you know, Snipper Clips, if you play that game with, you know, with as a single player for some of the stages, it just switching back and forth gets really, really, I don't know. It's not much fun. Let's put it that way. However, I was very pleasantly surprised by just how well this game has been crafted to deal with two protagonists swapping back and forth to solve puzzles. So before I get to the gameplay, let me just set you up with the premise. So the idea is this. You control a character named Rhyme who lives in a world of ice and snow, kind of an Arctic world, and then a character named Ember who lives in a perpetual summer. And these two characters, because they're called to adventure together, they end up meeting, sort of. They can see each other, but they can't reach each other. It's like they're in different dimensions, and those dimensions are almost crossing, but there's a line, a barrier that separates them, and they can't actually, like, reach out and touch each other. They're stuck in their worlds, but they can see each other. However, so what this allows for is for you to manipulate. They're in the same environment, right? So you might be standing in a place where there's a lake, but in Rhyme's world, that lake will be frozen over, meaning he can walk on top of the ice. Versus in Ember's world, the lake will not be frozen, so she can go underwater. And there's all sorts of other things in the environment that can be manipulated by the temperature of whoever's world happens to be, like, you know, covering it at that time. So, you know, like if you jump over, so you might have Ember on the left, which means summer on the left, and Rhyme on the right. And if they jump over each other, that will switch. So it'll be winter on the left and summer on the right.
The environments also, like, so, like, you're saying that if you jump from the left to the right, the environment swaps to the left side of the screen and vice versa?
Yeah, it'll change. It does it smoothly. It doesn't, like, have a herky jerky. So she's got her half of the screen, right? Her half of the barrier. And as she jumps, the barrier kind of repositions itself to follow her arc, the arc of her jump or his. And yeah, so it means as you're running along through these environments, you're constantly seeing both a summer and a winter version of them that changes as it passes through the barrier.
We're spring and autumn.
There is no spring and autumn, I'm afraid. They're saving that for the sequel. Basically what this allows for is them to concoct a lot of different puzzles. The idea of this game is you're running around through this world. There's a decrepit castle. These two characters meet and they fall in love, or at least in attraction with each other. Only they're star-crossed, right? Because they can never actually touch. And it's a very fairy tale-ish like atmosphere. It's very fairy tale. And there's narration throughout, which is very soothing and soft and very well done. I didn't really pay attention to the story so much because I'm so focused on the puzzles, but it was kind of nice having the narration in the background. I just sort of liked it. It just made the whole ambiance feel very relaxing and kind of, like I say, like a fairy tale. It was nice. So yeah, you're going through this old ruined castle and you're trying to collect scarves. I'm not entirely sure why they're scarves, but it doesn't really matter. And there's a dragon that you run into in the various stages. So the scarves work like stars in Super Mario 64. You know, you need so many stars to access a painting. Well, you need so many scarves to access certain doors in the castle. So, and then when you go through those doors, that's where all the puzzles will be then. You'll have this whole long path and along it will be several, you know, many, many, like up to 30 little vignettes where you can solve a puzzle. And most of them will be contained within one screen, but some of them are slightly larger. And you basically have to figure out how to manipulate the elemental aspects of your characters in order to solve puzzles. But they don't just do that. Basically, that's what the first stage will be about. But the second stage and on starts introducing new abilities, little wrinkles into this. So on one stage, you might have the ability to make that barrier solid. meaning you could walk on it. So if one person jumps over the other person and then pushes the button at the right time, all of a sudden that person who just jumped will have a floor beneath them. And that means they can reach higher places. Or you might have a stage where you've got, you're tethered, each character is tethered by a ball and chain. And I don't want to give away how clever they made this mechanic and how you, like, solving some of these puzzles was just simply a pleasure to me. Like, figuring out how to use some of the abilities and realizing that I could do certain things with their physics engine was just absolutely, like, I felt like a little kid figuring things out. It was really a lot of fun. And everything works so well. So let me get to the gameplay. That's the premise. Essentially, you're going around solving puzzles and collecting scarves. It's kind of like the Swapper, how you were just running around and you would have different rooms where you had to collect an orb. And it was all contained within that. The puzzle was contained within that room. And then you would leave the room and move on to a different room and a different puzzle. So this is the same way. It's like you collect the scarf and it's all contained within this little vignette. And then you move on to the next one. And you don't have to collect every scarf, because if you can't solve a puzzle, just move on and there'll be another puzzle that could be easier, could be, you know, whatever. You don't need all the scarves, just like you didn't need all the stars in order to be Super Mario 64. You just need to get enough of them. So what made this, like, to me, so the mechanics, the little abilities made it a lot of fun, but I was just blown away, or at least very surprised by how well they manage to craft these puzzles so that you're not doing tedious swapping. When you do swap characters, it feels like you're doing independent actions that keep the game flow moving forward, as opposed to you feeling like you're just positioning people. And that, I think, is very, very important, because I've played some other co-op puzzle games and I've done them single player. And I would count Snipperclips among this, where you just feel like you're positioning the players right. And it can take forever to position those characters. This does not feel that way. For the most part, rarely did it ever get tedious. It was the way they work together and interact, even in single player, I never got sick of swapping and controlling each character and moving them to the right spot and having them perform an action so that the next person could then perform the next action. It'll obviously work really well and probably, I guess you could say, better with two players. But even as a single player, their AI is also very, very good for a game that I've never heard of until it came out. It works really, really well just letting the characters run on their own as well. They don't solve puzzles for you, mind you. You're still going to have to direct them, but as far as getting them to follow you and just running around, it eliminates a lot of the tedium that character swapping can create.
Did you pick this game because of the person that wrote it being a writer yourself, or did you not know anything about the game prior?
I knew nothing but what I just happened to look at the trailer and I thought, you know what, I'm in the mood to review an indie game and this one looks fine. So I'm going to try this one. I honestly wasn't expecting much. I know that it does advertise that the writer of the story had worked on other big stories before, but that means nothing to me. Like,
so Chris Avalon, he's actually pretty big in the game industry. He used to work for Obsidian and left, and he became a freelancer. And yeah, it's interesting because I didn't even know that he was at all, like, involved in the making of this game, but apparently, yeah, he's doing all of these smaller indie games. He's actually one of the masterminds behind Into the Breach as well.
And I'd say as far as the story goes, like I said, it provided a nice ambiance, because as you're going through these vignettes, there's a narrator who's cluing you in under the feelings of the characters as they kind of fall in love. They're a young couple and everything, but it kind of, like, speaks to the tragedy of the situation that they, you know, they're being pushed apart. There's, you know, lots of different things. I really don't want to spoil it for anybody who wants to play, but some of the abilities are really, really clever. And the narrator encompasses that and how these abilities affect the characters emotionally. So while I'm not a big story guy, I found the story lent a very nice ambiance to this game. It contributed to the atmosphere that I found enjoyable, even though the particulars of the story didn't really matter much to me, because they never usually do in games. But it did add something. Like, I felt like the journey was had just a little more depth because of the narration that accompanied it. And it's just kind of, it made everything flow just a little bit better. For puzzle gamers, I really can't recommend this enough. I really put this up there with, I think the Swapper is the closest thing that I can, not in tone. The Swapper was a very dark sci-fi game, but in the way that it plays, I put this right up there with the Swapper, and I think that's one of the classic puzzle games of all time. I'm not going to say it's quite that good. There's a little bit of floaty controls, and there's some lack of polish. This is clearly an indie game, you know, and it could have possibly been a little more polished on certain things. But overall, I really can't find much negative to say about this. I was really, really impressed, especially for a game that that was not on my radar whatsoever. I walked away thinking, like, I just wanted to keep playing it. And it has a satisfying conclusion that I found to be pretty enjoyable.
All right, well, we have one more game left to talk about before we get to our main spot. And it's actually not really a review because we've only played the demo. At least I think we all played the demo.
Oh, you guys have. That's right. So, Yoshi's Crafted World. I did not play the demo because I know I'm going to buy Yoshi's Crafted World, and I never play demos when I know I'm going to buy the game. But you guys played it.
Yeah, so I actually just played it today, right before recording the podcast, and I was a little worried at first when I turned it on because the game does not look very good. We'll get to that soon. But I got to say, as soon as I jumped into it, it kind of felt like the kind of Yoshi game which I was hoping for and expecting, much like the Yoshi game that was released on the Wii U, which I absolutely loved and adored, although it was fairly easy, and I think I finished that game in a weekend, but that's great. I mean, look, I finished Resident Evil 2 in a weekend. I don't want my games to last me forever. This game is pretty much everything I expected it to be. It takes everything I liked about the previous game and everything I liked about Super Mario World 2 for the Super NES, when you actually get to play with Yoshi and you have like that aim system where you can like shoot targets from a distance. Like it has that mechanic, and I don't know, like I have a feeling I'm gonna finish this game in like 6 hours because it seems a little too easy. And the other problem I have, apart from the actual visuals, is that there's a casual mode and an easy mode, but there's no hard mode. So I guess if you want to 100% complete the game, you might put in a lot more time than the average gamer, but I still see myself finishing this game like right away. I don't think it's at all difficult.
No, it's not. I played through it too. I played through it twice, actually. Went through the demo and got everything twice. And I really liked it. I was really surprised. I was a pretty big fan of Yoshi's Woolly World, like you talked about on the Wii U. So this game runs on Unreal Engine 4. And so basically that's a third-party engine developed by Epic Games who makes Fortnite and everything. And Unreal Engine 4 has some serious problems with the Switch when it comes to performance. This is a very nice engine. It can run a lot of cool effects. But on the Switch, it has some issues, specifically with the Switch's CPU. So for reference, Yoshi's Woolly World on the Wii U, last-gen system, ran at 720p, 60 FPS, basically locked. This game runs at less than 720p about 99% of the time, according to Digital Foundry. It hits that 60 FPS mark really well, but if you have a 4K TV or anything like that, you're going to be seeing less than HD standards, you know, for most of the time you're playing it.
It looks terrible. I have a 4K TV. It looks terrible. I had to, like, switch it handheld.
Yeah, on a handheld, it runs even worse. It goes down to something around 480p, which
But at least it's smaller.
Yeah, like, it's smaller.
Like, you can see the pixels, and it felt blocky. It just... Yeah. It was like really? The game was made for the N64, and they ported it to the Switch.
Yeah, that's because Goodfeel, like I said, went with that Unreal Engine 4. See, Nintendo normally builds their engines in-house, and so they went with a third-party engine for this, because, you know, Goodfeel is one of their, I think, second-party companies that works for them. And it's just... It's a strange decision. I mean, they get some pretty cool lighting effects and everything by going with Unreal Engine 4, but it just looks so... Okay, so I can't really speak to this as much because my TV is like 10 feet away from my couch, and I have a 1080p set with a pretty decent upscaler, so it really hides a lot of those downfalls being so far back and being just a 1080p set. The actual visual design of the world is amazing, right? The cardboard looks so cute. I mean, everything is adorable.
It really is. It's like the Nintendo Labo we wanted.
Yeah, it's like it's made out of everything... I mean, it's just...
Because it's a cardboard world, right?
Yeah, like, it's the most adorable game ever. But
does it look tactile, at least?
Yes. It's got that really... So basically, you look at Yoshi, he looks like a tennis ball, right? I mean, he looks really, I guess the word fuzzy, right? The cardboard looks really cool. There's a lot of these small little details that make it look good from a visual design perspective. I'm just personally a little disappointed from a technical perspective because I really wish Goodfield would have just went with like an in-house engine, maybe use the, I don't know how feasible this is, but use the Yoshi's Woolly World engine and upgrade a little bit for Switch, because we've seen some ports from Wii U, right? I mean, something like that maybe would have been a little bit better. Maybe they couldn't do that. I mean, I'm not behind
but
the scenes.
But why couldn't they? I mean, Yoshi game was made on a different engine, so why didn't they just use that engine? Because why fix something that ain't broke? Like,
There's so many different reasons. There might not have been like the textures they needed. They might have wanted to go for something different. There could be incompatibilities with, you know, with the Switch. I mean, you see ports like Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, but there's a lot of reworking that has to go into that, and they can't really bump up the graphics much because that engine was tailored for the Wii U, right? I mean, I would have liked to see a modified version of that Woolly World engine running here, but like I said, I'm no tech person, so I can't really dive deep into what the reasoning is.
The last Kirby game, I thought it was a lot of fun to play. I had a blast playing it. But when you compare it to the Kirby game released on the Wii U, which was not as fun to play, but will look gorgeous. And now we're getting the exact same thing happen with Yoshi. Like, I'm hoping that this game will be more fun to play than Yoshi's Woolly World. But in terms of, like, the graphics and the look and style, the art design, it pales in comparison to the previous generation, which I find baffling.
Well, Kirby, my big issue with that game, Kirby Star Allies, was it ran at 30 FPS. And so for a platformer, I think that's just inexcusable. Platformers just aren't meant to run at 30 FPS. It just feels too slow and floaty. With Kirby, it works decent. But it would have been better off being on running at 60 FPS and making some visual sacrifices. That being said, it's just a downfall of going with the Switch, right? Because the way the Switch is set up with the different handheld and TV profiles, they're always going to prioritize the level of detail over resolution. You see other game developers do this all the time. If something looks more detailed but runs at a lower resolution, people will like that better than if something's less detailed and runs at a higher resolution. So that's what they're going for here. I admire that. It hits at 60 FPS mark 90% of the time. I mean, it's really solid 60 FPS gameplay. And if that's what they had to do to get it running 60 FPS, it's fine by me. I'd rather have this game running at 60 FPS at like 600p than running at 30 at 1080. I mean, that's just the way it is.
But you're saying it hits 90% of the time, but yet it at times looks really bad. Throughout the whole entire game. It really depends. Like when you start up the game right away, it looks terrible. And when you get into the actual level, when you're playing the game, it doesn't look so bad. Maybe it's because you're just too preoccupied, like you said, looking at all the details, and there's so much to soak in, and you're trying to solve these puzzles and see things in the distance and in the background. Like, you have to like look for hidden clues and find these cows. And
yeah,
you know,
that cow thing was one of my favorite parts. So I live at home still, and I have a bunch of siblings. Right, I have six siblings. Three of them are under seven. So yeah, so they helped me find these cows. And that was one of the most fun things I've done in the game in a long time. So these cows are hidden in the background. They're little cardboard cutouts. And I asked them, you know, guys, I need your help finding these cows. And they actually found some that I had no idea were there. I just wandered right past it. They're like, okay, go back. There's a cow there. And that was just such a fun experience. Yoshi's one of those series that I love playing with my younger siblings because, or just they watch me while I play. They love it because it's just so appealing. He's so cute. It just works so well. And that's one of my favorite things about it. And it's just such a fuzzy and like warm, you know, hugs and chocolate sort of family friendly game that I really like about it.
Just to be clear, I'm sold. I'm going to buy the game. Like, yeah. I had enough fun with the demo to actually buy the game. It's the perfect game to buy if you have kids. Your kids will love the game. They'll love Yoshi. They'll love all the characters. It's easy to play, easy to learn, easy to pick up.
Yeah, and like I said, the gameplay, I was not sold on this game when I was getting ready to play the demo. I was not sold on the concept. Yoshi games are always a little too easy for me, and just to really enjoy them the whole time you're playing through them. But this, when I played it, I was like, wow, it really impressed me. And I'm really looking forward to getting it in on March 29th. Is that when it comes out?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. March 29th.
But you know what? I said the same thing for Yoshi's Woolly World. I'm like, this game is way too easy. But then I realized that, yeah, it's way too easy just to like run through it and try to finish the game. But if you want to 100% complete the game, it's not that easy.
Yeah, they got
that's
some
where you have to challenge yourself.
Really hard collectibles to find or whatever.
But, and the I think the appeal of those games is just being able to sit back and relax and explore, as opposed to feeling like you're under doing tense platforming. It's a lot harder to explore a world when there's tense platforming involved. I like the feel of Yoshi games are just a different kind of game. I don't need them to be like Mario games. They have their own sort of in my book, they're taking over Kirby's like the nice platformer sort of niche, because I think they're more creative in their design than Kirby has been in quite a while.
It's going to be like it's going to be one of those things like when you're playing Super Mario Odyssey and you want to get all the costumes, because this game is going to be insane. Like, I think Yoshi has like over 600 costumes or some stupidness. Like, for if you're one of those people that really wants to get every single one of those costumes, it might take you forever. But also, this game is built for multiplayer mode, so you can actually play with more than one person at the exact same time.
Yeah, which should be fun. Which was like Woolly World, I guess. And I think I'm looking forward to this quite a bit.
Yeah, same here.
And I also don't have a 4K TV, so, and I sit 10 feet back, just like
there you go.
So I'm guessing it's going to look okay.
Yeah, you won't even notice. I mean, you won't be like, wow, this is sharp. But, I mean, you won't even notice. I was like, man, the first thing I thought was, man, this game looks good when I booted it up. It wasn't until I actually got close. I'm like, well, this is what most people are going to see because they sit closer to their TV.
All right. That pretty much wraps up. We've been playing a lot, as you guys could tell. But that pretty much wraps it up. So when we come back, we're going to just have a little short segment on some of our gaming habits. And, you know, do we buy indies? Do we buy AAA games? How does that work? All right, we'll be back in a little bit. Hey guys, we're back, and just to wrap things up, we're gonna have a little short segment here to talking about some of our gaming habits. So recently, Isaac and I were discussing, you know, how we buy games, and Isaac, you were saying you don't really buy a lot of indie games, whereas, you know, Rick and I, we play a lot of indies for the show, and we check out indies and stuff like that, as well as the big AAA games. But Isaac, you were saying that typically hasn't been the case with you.
No, I've tried to steer clear of indies. Basically, a lot to do with, like, because I think they're kind of short. You know, they're only on digital, and I don't really feel like they're really consistently made a lot of the times. And so I've generally tend to put most of my attention towards AAA Nintendo games, right? Or AAA is not really Nintendo, but Nintendo games and maybe a couple of AAA games or Steam games I'm interested in, right? I don't really put much attention towards indies because from my perspective, just the way it's been, the way I've thought in the past is, why would I play an indie from this genre when I can go back and play a classic Nintendo game from that genre and then have the history behind that and then be able to talk to other people who also play that classic, you know, Nintendo game? So, like, why would I play this indie RPG where I can go back and play one of the, you know, the great JRPGs from the late 90s or something, right? Like Chrono Cross, right? Why would I do that?
Mm-hmm. Why would you play Chrono Cross?
You mean Chrono Trigger?
No, I mean, like
Chrono Cross was never released on a Nintendo console. You mean Chrono Trigger?
No, I mean Chrono Cross because I played Chrono Trigger a long time ago. I played that a lot. I'm talking about, like, I play other games, right? Too, right?
Yeah,
but why would I just go back and clean up some of those really good from that golden age of JRPGs?
And I think you could definitely look at it that way. You could go back and play some classics. What I found exploring some indies are where you can find these in sort of the AA games too, but the diamonds in the rough, like I just described Degrees of Separation as, I consider that to be a diamond in the rough. I mean, that just came out of nowhere and took me by surprise as to how quality it is. And I think there are several other games, there are lots of indies that you can find that really deliver, they pack a punch for though they may have a shorter experience, although that's not always the case. I was talking with you about Hollow Knight, which I have put a good 60 some hours into, and it takes about maybe 40-45 hours to beat that game. I put that up there in Super Metroid quality. Honestly, I think Nintendo would have been proud to make Hollow Knight. That's how good that game is, and that's made by three people in Australia. I don't understand. I find that to be fascinating, and I love playing some indies to see these sort of different takes that these people have on established genres. So you could definitely go back and play classics, and there's nothing wrong with that. But there are some really good spins on some of these genres. Yoku's Island Express was another example of a really great spin on the Metroid genre. SteamWorld Dig 2, another great spin on the Metroid genre. So stuff like that, that's the reason why I play indies, because you have these little surprises that come along, and I find those to be really, really refreshing. I love Nintendo games, obviously, but the indies are a nice compliment.
it's not to say I've never played indies. Like, I played Stardew Valley and, like, really like that a lot on Switch. But that's kind of, like, one of the more popular indies. So I guess that really is not as much of an indie as others. And I had never played a Harvest Moon game or anything. So it was kind of a new experience.
But you played Animal Crossing. Well, I guess
I had, but they're not the same. Right. Honestly, Stardew Valley is a way better, like, for me personally, it's way better. It's more interesting than something like Animal Crossing, because actively being involved, there's no real world timers. I really don't like real world timers in games. All that sort of stuff makes it just more enjoyable for me. Like, I like the vegetable idea better than, like, I don't know, buying furniture or something.
Now, Rick, what is your, like, what's your experimentation policy? Like, how do you determine which indie games you get and which ones you don't? Maybe outside the codes we get from developers.
My biggest problem is time. And, I mean, I guess everyone can say that. But the thing is, like, I always have to place a priority on Nintendo games or games on a Nintendo console, because I am one of the co-hosts of this podcast, which is a Nintendo podcast. But the thing is, the reason why I like playing a lot of indie games, A, it's because usually I'm pretty good on choosing the right ones, and usually I'm satisfied with the indie games I pick. But it's also because they happen to usually be a lot shorter. Stardew Valley is a game that you can put 100 hours into it if you wanted to. But if I look at the Nintendo Switch, my five favorite games, like, if I'm going to list off my five favorite games, three of those five are indie games. Like, Breath of the Wild, probably number one. Number two, Salt and Sanctuary, made by two people, a husband and wife. Number three would be Inside, made by Playdead Studios. And I would put Golf Story in the top five. Again, an indie game made by a small studio. And I put in like 40-something hours into Golf Story. I like Golf Story so much, I actually repurchased it. I got the physical copy. So originally it was only released digitally. I got the physical special edition, which cost me like a good $50, because I love that game so much. And I know I'm going to play it again and again. It's like, for me, it's like Earthbound of this generation.
Agreed. And it's an example of one of those games that puts a spin on an established genre, the RPG, by combining it with a golf game. But anyway, sorry to interrupt.
The thing is that, like, my favorite game of the year so far is Resident Evil 2. That is also a remake of one of the greatest games ever made. And even if I look at Nintendo, and I love Nintendo, and I love Nintendo games, be it Zelda or Super Mario, but as much as they try to change things around, usually a lot of it seems familiar. It's the same sort of weapons, or the same sort of, like, gameplay and style, and the exact same ways to jump and swing your sword, and similar dungeons, etc., etc. And when you play these indie games, it's like it introduces you to these worlds and characters and stories and narratives that you just never ever experienced before. And that's why I feel like, especially when you discover a game that you've never heard of, like the game that you were just talking about earlier on, and you know nothing about the game, you buy the game, you play the game, you end up loving the game, and it exceeds your expectations. Finding those hidden gems reminds me of when I was a kid, and I used to go to the video store, and I used to choose my VHS or DVD rentals based on the cover of the DVD or the VHS box.
Yep.
Like, if it had an amazing cover, like Evil Dead 2 or, I don't know, Wild Zero or any of these movies, right? They just had these cool covers, and I never heard of this movie prior. I would rent it based on the cover, which is part of marketing, right? And I would bring it home, and the movie would blow me away, and I would go tell all my friends about this movie that I've never heard of, because it's not marketed and advertised on TV. You don't see it on commercials. It's like this low budget movie that you just kind of like have to discover by word of mouth. And I kind of feel like indie games are the same way. Like, you don't see these games being advertised on TV, like while you're watching your television shows, right? During commercial break, you don't see advertisements for games like Inside or Golf Story or Hollow Knight. And so the only way to really know about these games is to read blogs, video game blogs, or publications like IGN or Goomba Stomp or Polygon or whatever, and or by word of mouth. Like, you, someone has a Nintendo Switch and they tell you to pick up a game because it's great. Like, then you pick it up and you trust your friend that, yeah, you're going to like the game. So to me, it seems like a bit more rewarding. And the thing is that I think that we all kind of want to play the big games because, yeah, they're the big games, and we have this attachment to the Zelda series and the Super Mario series. And you also want to be in on the conversation, right? I think we talked about this on the last episode, where sometimes we feel the pressure to want to buy games right away, at least the big ones, because you want to be in on the conversation when the game's released. Everyone's talking about it. You want to talk about the story or whatever it is, the ending, et cetera, et cetera. But having those indie games in between the big games is great, because if I'm waiting for Zelda and Super Mario to come out, and in between those two games, there's like a 3-month window, right? So I can play an indie game in between that might only take me 10 hours to finish. So that's what I like. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is I usually play one big AAA title, and in between my AAA titles, I will play at least one indie game. Are they all winners? No. But, you know, I seem to choose, right? I follow a lot of, like, websites. I read a lot of reviews. I listen in on, like, podcasts, and I'm pretty happy with my selection so far. I actually have, guys, I have well over 100 games on my Nintendo Switch. That includes packages like, you know, the Sega Classic Genesis package that I got for Christmas. I also have the Bandai Namco Classic package, which each of those has, like, hundreds of games within. But I still have, I think, over 100 individual games on my Switch. And a lot of them I finish within, like, 10 hours because they're short, sweet, like, indie games.
That's a big issue for me, though. It's a positive for you, but for me, it's probably one of the biggest problems is that all these games are digital only. So as a person who resells pretty much every game, whether they like it or not, for the most part, unless it's a true all-time classic, not being able to sell it if I don't like it is a big detriment. Because there's nothing worse feeling for me than spending $15, which is not much, granted. But spending $15 on a game, it's terrible, you hate it, and then you just can't get your money back. It's not like Steam, where, you know, you spend $15, the game's terrible, you play it less than 2 hours, you can return it, right? As long as it's within 2 weeks. Nintendo has no such policy.
You've got a budget. I understand you have a budget and you want to save it for the great games, although I would argue this. You know, a game like Kirby Star Allies only takes about 5 hours to beat, and that was a $60 game. Yep. And if you resell it, you get maybe $40 back. And so you've spent $20 on a 5-hour game, which is the same as you could have spent $10 on a 5-hour game played in India, and you can't resell it, but you still spent less.
That's good logic, Patrick. So, really it worked out with Star Allies for me. I got it for $48 on Amazon because of the now defunct Prime membership discount. Then I sold it for like $49. And so it ended up for me, I only ended up spending about $10 on it because of after the fees and everything, right? But that's totally a good point.
You could have taken that $49 that you made back when selling Kirby and used that to buy 4 indie games. Yeah, maybe you cannot sell those indie games afterwards, but at the end of the day, you got 5 games for the price of 1.
Yeah, but the way I look at it is this. You talk about indie games kind of being like diamonds in the rough. That's another problem I kind of have with it. It's just like when I buy a game, I check my 4 big sites to see if I want to purchase it. I check Metacritic to see the scores. I check Amazon to read the customer reviews. I check Common Sense Media to check the content, because there's nothing worse than getting a game and then the content is something I don't like, or like it's super violent or something, and I just don't jive with that. Or there's just like a, because, you know, like I said, I'm around kids all the time, so I like having games I can play that I'm around them, because guess what? They're where the TV's at. So having games that you can play when you're around kids and share with your family is a whole lot better than having games you have to play all the time by yourself when you don't have that much time, right?
And okay, I will say this. So I was going to say, so I did refer to something like Degrees of Separation as a diamond in the rough, because the Nintendo Switch has a ton of games come out for it that I've never heard about, right? Like, you could read all the gaming websites in the world and you'll never hear about these games. They just come out for the Switch, and those, that's the rough, okay? But a game like, but there are lots of indie games that actually are getting really, really good scores and good reviews. A game like Golf Story didn't go unnoticed by everybody. I wouldn't call that one a diamond in the rough. That one was highly anticipated from the beginning. Or a game like Hollow Knight, highly anticipated because people had seen the footage. It was a Kickstarter and they were sharing everything. And everybody was saying, knowing that it was shaping up to be very good. And then when it came out, nearly every publication reviewed it. And it got great scores across the board. Same with games like Golf Story. So there are plenty of critically acclaimed indies that you can find in almost every single genre that you can also find just a lot of documentation on, so that you can do your research properly and you can figure out, just like with a AAA game, whether that game is for you or not. The rough, yes, it is. It's, you have to be a bit of a romantic to peruse the rough, okay? Like, sometimes I do have that. I sometimes will play a game on a whim and I end up, I bought Wandersong because of some of the things that people have been saying about it, and I ended up not really caring for that game much at all. I beat it, but I regretted purchasing it. I take chances every. That's my personality, though. I like to take chances on things that sometimes I know, like, okay, Wandersong's not really a genre for me because it's more story based, but everybody's talking about it in a certain way. I might give it a shot. Okay, I didn't like it, and I spent, I think it was $20 on it. I'm not happy with that, but at the same time, there are several established games, you know, that I knew I was going to like. I knew I was going to like Golf Story just based on the footage from it and all the what all the reviews were saying about it. So there are less risky indie games, for sure. Like, you don't have to feel like you're wading through the sea of anonymity and just hoping you find, you know, an island out there to land on. You could definitely check out lots of, like Stardew Valley, right? Like, that was an established, that was a game that had anticipation, and everybody's covered it, right? You can read plenty about Stardew Valley. And there are lots of other indie games like that.
Although I am an example in arguing against myself, because there is one Switch game, one indie I have bought. I loved it. I've played it a ton with my family. And that's, ironically enough, I got it for 50 cents, and I got it for free with my Nintendo points. And that's Astro Bear's Party on Switch, which is like this goofy little party game. It's like four-player Snake. And it is, no kidding, one of my favorite games to play with my family on Switch, because it's so easy to pick up and play. It's just so goofy, but it's kind of addictive and fun to play in like groups of four. It is just, you know, a blast, and it was free, but basically I paid 50 cents in Nintendo points for it. And that's crazy. That's an example of what you're talking about. And I get that.
I was just going to tell you that a lot of the indie games on the Switch are great for multiplayer modes, like Juggernauts, Lovers in a Dangerous Space Time, Overcooked 2. There's tons and tons of indie games that are just perfectly suited for you, because if you want to play with your brothers and sisters, nephews, and I don't know how many kids you have running around, but yeah, like those games, you can have up to like four players, sometimes even more, and they're all kid friendly. They're all super fun to play. Yeah, and so like some of these games, like you can put in like a good 20, 30 hours into playing these games, and so even if you spend $10 on a game, and yeah, maybe it's digital, not physical, you're going to get your money's worth. But, you know, talking about gaming habits, though, like we seem to be focused specifically on what kind of games we buy, like AAA versus indie. But what I don't understand is I don't even understand why I'm the type of person that buys physical copies, because I never sell my games.
That's what I've always wondered.
I think the thing is because I kind of feel like, okay, I guess it's the collector in me. I've always collected things since I was like a young kid, you know, be it G.I. Joe's or He-Man or hockey cards or whatever. But it's because I feel like I do not physically, like, I don't own the game. Like, if I don't physically own it, I feel like I just do not own it. Like, if it's just a digital copy, I feel like it's not my game. What happens if my Switch breaks? What happens if I forget my password to my account? What happens if it's 5 years from now and I want to play the game and I can't play the game because I can't connect on whatever system? I don't know. I just, for some reason, it just feels like it doesn't belong to me if it's not a physical copy. And I feel like I'm just throwing my money into
It's tough to reconcile that sometimes with indies are, it's kind of like you're renting a movie, you know, you're keeping it and you get to keep it for as long as you can, but eventually it's probably going to go away. Eventually you're not going to own that indie. Now, it's very possible that your cartridges, your discs could become corrupted over time and, you know, you won't be able to play that game anyway, or your system will break down or something like that. But in the end, I do tend to sell, like, I don't sell every game, Isaac. I don't know if you keep some of your physicals. Like, the games that I really like Breath of the Wild, Super Mario Odyssey, I'm not selling those games because I know I'll replay them eventually. Speaking of habits, I'm a guy who replays games. Like, I finished Hollow Knight, put 50 hours into it, then I decided to play it again and go back and experience it in a different way. I do tend to replay games that I really like and replay them a lot. Like Starlink, I 100%ed it on the easy mode and the normal mode. But I do sell anything that I'm kind of so on. I have a good idea of whether I'm going to play this game again. I like to buy physical because I probably will sell and use that to buy either eShop credit, because I know I'll be playing some indies, or another game if something good is coming out.
Yeah, so I'm like a minimalist at heart when it comes to this sort of thing, just in general life philosophy. But also when it comes to games, and so I just keep my, in physical copies, my like favorite childhood games, and then games I haven't got around to playing yet. So like Link Between Worlds, I haven't got around to playing yet on 3DS. I have a physical copy of that. When I'm done with that, I'll probably sell it, right? But like my favorite games, I actually get digital most of the time. So I knew I was gonna love the new Smash. I got it digital. Smash Wii U, I bought digital because I knew I was gonna put hundreds of hours into these. I put 300 hours into Smash Wii U. I put 120, 130 into Smash on Switch right now. And so I didn't want to be swapping out cartridges all the time, right? Or swapping out discs or anything like that.
Sure.
But that's generally who I am. I generally just play one game at a time. Like, well, there's my one. Like, I played a lot of Overwatch on PC, and then I played a lot of Smash on Switch, right? I generally don't hop around and play a bunch of different games. That's kind of my habit, right, is I pick one game, like Smash. I want to be good at Smash. So I play Smash for hundreds of hours to get better at playing it, which is a very multiplayer-centric sort of mentality.
I'm surprised you do that, because, like, for example, with me, if say, like, let's say I bought Resident Evil 2, like, I bought the digital version, right? I could not lend it to my nephew 3 days later after I finished the game so he can play the game and finish it, because he would have to actually be at my house playing on my PlayStation 4. And the same applies to any of my Nintendo games. Like, I lent him Splatoon, I lent him Mario Kart, I lent him a bunch of Nintendo games. And if I only had the digital version, I could not lend it to my nephews.
That's a good point. So,
but also, like, I bring my games to work and stuff, and I don't want to have to bring my whole entire Switch. And also, I don't like the idea of putting my Switch on someone else's dock for some reason. I feel like it's going to curse it. So, but I can just bring my... Seriously,
like sitting on somebody else's toilet.
Yeah. I'll just bring my game, right? And I have my Legend of Zelda carrying kit case, whatever you call it, and I can stuff in like 20 games and bring them all to work, and I'll have to carry on my actual Switch.
Yeah, I get that. I just don't have any friends to lend games to. So that's not a problem.
I don't lend out games too much either, but I do like having the option of selling them. And if I did, I have in the past occasionally lent out games. It's a nice thing to be able to have, just in case. But even still, like I say, I pretty much know, for instance, Link Between Worlds, I have kept that. And I will always keep that. As long as I have a 3DS, which I expect to be forever because it was a great system, I'll always have a Link Between Worlds, because I think I played that game through the end 4 or 5 times. I know I'll replay it again. It's one of my favorite Zelda games of all time.
Once I finish with a system, so for example, my 2DS, there's only probably 5 or 6 games left I want to play on the DS and 3DS library. And then after that, I might sell it. I might sell the whole system or give it to a family member, or give it to my siblings that's younger. Because for me, I've already played every game that's ever going to come out probably on 2DS and 3DS, you know, after I finish Link Between Worlds and some other essentials that I'm ever going to want to play. My Wii U, for example, I'm going to play Star Fox Zero and a couple more games. And then it's going to go to my family, going to go to some of my younger siblings, because I don't need it anymore. Like, all the good Wii U games have been ported to Switch. Metroid Prime Trilogy, which is like the only thing, and Xenoblade Chronicles, the original, like the only two things I would want to play on again on Wii U. And they're probably eventually going to get ported to the Switch. Or I can always play the Xenoblade Chronicles on the Wii I have, right?
And or so X.
And so I kind of let those systems pass out of my, it's just a different habit, right? Like, kind of let those systems pass out of my life once I've used up all the stuff on them. Like my PS.
I mean, at the end of the day, it really doesn't mean anything. It's just this thing that you own, right? Like, there's a part of me that just wants to move to an island and leave everything behind. I don't necessarily want to sell everything in case I ever want to come back and I change my mind, but I would love to just escape from all of this stuff, like all of this, like, stuff that I love, but just all of this clutter and DVDs. And actually, it's not really clutter because I keep my house clean, but you know what I'm trying to say, like, just escape from all of it.
Your possessions can weigh you down, so there is something very very freeing about not having much. You know, there's something to be said about letting, like you say, letting a system go. I keep mine around. It's about what you might get out of it in the end. That's what we're really talking about here, is different gaming habits. There's no right or wrong way, obviously, to play. Yeah, so I know that I'm going to want to play these again because I like them so much. They're how I relax after work or whatever. So I know I'm going to want to pick up a Link Between Worlds sometime down the line. So I keep it because, you know, I could sell it and I could get something new out of it, but you know, I'm going to want to play it. And I'm going to want to play Breath of the Wild again someday. I don't want to now, but I'm going to eventually. It's such a big game.
That's why I keep around my copies of like Metroid Prime 1 and 2 and Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door on GameCube, right? Those are my like childhood classic games. And NBA Live 06. Those are like my childhood classic games. And I keep them in my original GameCube in this big, heavy 70-pound CRT TV, which is not very minimalist, by the way.
around, that weighs you down.
I keep those around because they are like my favorite things, right? I basically, when I decided to be kind of minimalist in the way I approach things, I decided I'm going to keep my favorite things around. I don't need to keep everything. I don't need to keep every scrap of Nintendo-related things I've bought over the years. I just need to keep my favorite stuff. And that CRT is a family relic, and it's one of my favorite things. GameCube, one of my favorite things. Stuff like that, right? And that's kind of what makes it so special. Like, I love turning on that TV and to hear that degaussing noise when it turns on and everything, because it reminds me of my childhood and reminds me of growing up. And by the time I turn on that GameCube and you hear that's, you know, that GameCube boot up sound. So those sort of things are very special. The 3DS, I don't have those same attachments to. And so that's why I'm willing to let something like that go. Wii U, don't have the same attachments. But the GameCube, I'll probably always keep, maybe not this giant TV, but the GameCube I'll probably always keep, because it's just something that I remember my childhood with, right? And that's just one of my favorite things to keep. But
the only reason why I hold on to the Wii U is because of Super Mario World 3D.
Yeah, and when that gets ported to that's another game, right? When that gets ported to Switch, yep. And the Wii U's gonna go sayonara or go to somebody who might enjoy it.
It'll be pretty useless. Mine will probably just go to my nieces after that.
There you go. That's an example. That's what I was talking about. This example, just you pass the joy on to somebody else, because if it's sitting underneath my bed or in my closet, what am I doing with it? That somebody else could get some joy out of it, right? And somebody in my family, I can make them smile, introduce them to a game, introduce them to something that really, could change them or make them see like, wow, games are more than just like things you do on your phone or things people play to, like Fortnite or something, right? It's more than that. It's a bigger thing. And wow, these are more of these than I expected. That's kind of what I pass those systems on for, like that.
I would be scared of giving my Wii U to someone because they might like hate me for it. They're like, well, what is this garbage?
Luckily, my nieces are young enough where they wouldn't think of a gaming system as garbage. They would still be amazed, and all they'd have to see is, I'm just trying to brainwash them to be Nintendo fans. So all they need to see now is Mario, and they'll like it, or Pokemon, and they'll like it.
There you go.
There was a time where I really liked the Wii U and defended it, and then the Switch came along, and I'm like, oh god, was I ever?
Yeah, I wrote that article that was like, no, Nintendo doesn't need third parties. Back that was how deep I got in the trenches during the Wii U era. I was like, no, I rolled up my sleeves, and I did my work, and now it's paying off because Nintendo's actually competent again. But man, those were some hard days, Rick. You're talking about having to get down the trenches and debate all the Nintendo haters.
We really got to end this podcast, but I'm just going to say this. The last thing I'm going to say, when we started the podcast, there was no Switch. There was a Wii U with like two games to review.
Yeah, it was a struggle sometimes.
There was nothing like,
we did a lot of episodes based around classic games back then.
Yep. Nothing but the Wii U and hopes and dreams, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Switch has seen better days. All right, and with that, I think we'll wrap it up. That was a good talk, guys. Good talk. All right, so Isaac, where can we find you online?
You find me at Goomba Stomp. Just wrote an article about how Super Mario 3D Land is the best game on the 3DS.
All right, there you go. Well, I will debate you with Link Between Worlds, but go check out Isaac's article so that you can prove him wrong. Rick, where can we find you online?
You can find me writing at GoombaStomp.com, and you can always follow the official Twitter account for GoombaStomp, which is GoombaStomp, and like us on Facebook, and I guess that's about it.
Yeah, and you can find me, of course, on GoombaStomp as well. I usually write for the Sword and Cinema, which is our film section, but I do write for video game stuff as well, and I'll have my written review of Degrees of Separation. It should be out by the time this podcast is live. But check out the film section, too. If you're into games, you're probably into movies. We just had two major film festivals go on. One was Berlinale, which we covered, got a ton of movies from. And then also Sundance happened. So check out our Sundance Film Festival coverage and everything on Sword Cinema. There's some big movies coming out this year, so you're going to see a lot of good reviews up on Sword Cinema. Anyway, that should do it for this week. We'll be back again next week. Talk to you guys later. Oh,